Yeah, first I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation. It's a real honor to be able to give a talk here. And maybe I should say a few words about myself, because I only know a very small number of you. So I'm not really a physicist. I'm a computer scientist. And I come from the part of computer science that's interested in, well, it's a field called formal semantics of programming languages. And the idea is that, you know, computer scientists like to separate syntax and semantics and think in the sense. So in that sense, it's similar to logic and the traditional of universal algebra. And that's the kind of direction that I'm going to be coming from. And I'm really pleased that Ross gave a talk before me, because at the start of the talk, kind of Ross's talk, he said that he was interested in kind of building up this algebraic universe and finding quantum computation living inside. Right, so I want to do something similar, but maybe even more crazy. Right? So if you're gonna, I mean, I was thinking if one of you was asked what you would have to learn before you understood Hopf algebra, right? Let's say you had an undergraduate student who was interested in sort of studying and learning about it. I guess first you'd point that student to sort of abstract algebra, learn what a field is, learn what linear algebra is, you know, learn what associative algebra is, and then once you know that, then you can sort of discover and enjoy Hopf algebra, right? So this is just, this talk is about sort of completely turning everything around. In the style of category theory, you just turn all the arrows around. So we're going to start with Hopf algebra in this particular sense that I'm coming to the subject from, and sort of reinvent linear algebra within this field. And then once we've discovered linear algebra, we'll be able to discover what a field is. So it's we're just going the other direction. And I've split the talk into three parts. So the first part, I want to sort of give you the perspective that I'm coming to these algebraic structures from, which is very different, I think, from what many of you think of biogebras and Hopf algebras. I'm calling this a computer science perspective, but maybe it's just my own personal perspective. And then I'll tell you about this particular algebraic theory that is going to serve as this sort of playground for linear algebra. And then at the end, I'll just show you how one does linear algebra in this setting. And I thought I'd start by explaining what I mean by this computer science perspective. And it's all about sort of separating the syntax that you talk about things from the meaning of those things. And even though, I mean, my background is also, I studied a fair bit of mathematics. And I think even mathematicians sometimes, they tend to sort of confuse the two. In computer science, it's always a very clear division. And here's just some examples of this. I mean, maybe you've heard of some of these things, things like regular expressions in regular languages, context-free grammars and context-free languages. And then there's this whole sort of subfield of computer science which is interested in mathematics, things like domain theory that help you to understand the syntactic constructs and the behavior of programming languages. And all of this is kind of built on earlier things. So, and these things that, you know, go back to late 19th century, early 20th century. So things like considering the syntax of logic and considering the models of logic. And then later in the 1930s, we had universal algebra. So things like Birkhoff variety theorem, where the idea was that you were building up this universal framework to talk about algebraic theories. And that's really going to be the starting point of this talk. And I thought I'd sort of just give you a very quick reminder of what this looks like. So the idea is that you want to think of a presentation of an algebraic theory as a pair of two things. So we have a signature and a set of equations or relations. And I want to concentrate on two particular examples. So the two examples are commutative monoids and abelian groups. Okay, so for commutative monoids, our signature simply contains the multiplication. Now, everything in the signature has an arity, which just means that you associate a natural number with the operation. And that basically means how many arguments this operation takes. Okay, so multiplication takes 2 arguments. And this is the identity element of the commutative monoid, and it takes 0 arguments, right? It's a constant of the theory. Now, the equations are pairs of something which I'm going to call type terms. All that I mean by this is that I can construct, using this sort of signature, I can construct syntactic terms, so these are basically trees, and I can use all of the things in my signature, and additionally, I can use some variables. So here I've used some variables. So you have typically you assume something like there exists a countable set of variables that you can use to build up your terms. And by typed, I just mean, you know, this term here uses variables x, y, and z. So these 2 terms use the same variables. And of course, this is just the associativity equation, the commutativity, and the unitality. For abelian groups, additionally, we're going to have a unary operation, the inverse, and an additional equation that just tells us that x times x inverse is the identity element. And you see, this is a particularly interesting equation because the variable x appears twice, and I'm going to come back to this a little bit later on. So that was the syntax. What is semantics then? Well, semantics is to give a model of such a thing. Okay, so to give a model of such a thing, I have to pick some set, some carrier set. And then for every operation, I have to give a function. Okay, so the operation here, the multiplication was of arity 2, and that means I have to give a function from x squared to x. Okay, this guy was of arity 0, so I have to give a function from x to the 0 to x. X to the 0, of course, is just the 1 element set, so it just picks up the identity element. And the inverse will be a unary operation, so just a function from x to x. And now you require, for this to be a well-defined model, you want to ensure that for each valuation of the variable, so for each function that I give from this countably infinite set of variables to x, each equation in my system must hold. So if you sort of think about this for a second, you'll see that to give a model, for example, of the algebraic theory of commutative monoids is the same thing to give a commutative monoid. To give a model of the algebraic theory of abelian groups is just the same as to give an abelian group in the classical sense. Yeah? So that was the 1930s, so now we're skipping about 30 years. And I want to talk a little bit about the thesis of Bill Lovere. Okay, so Bill Lovere was not very happy with universal algebra. So I'll give a couple of reasons for why one might not be happy with universal algebra as some kind of universal approach to algebraic structures. So one reason is that it's all too set theory specific, right? So there are examples such as topological groups, for example, that are not merely sets, right? The topological spaces and the operations are continuous maps. And somehow, you know, if you want a universal approach to algebraic structures, then you should be able to encompass examples like topological groups. And the other reason why one might not be too happy about this kind of usual setup is that there's all this ad hoc extraneous machinery, right? So this countable set of variables, variable evaluation maps, etc. That it's not really clear maybe it's not obvious immediately what role they play in all of this. Okay, so Lovere invented something called functorial semantics. And this is really a quite a beautiful way, I think, of doing universal algebra categorically. So I want to give you a flavor of how this works. And by the way, this is probably not the way a category theorist would do it. It's going to be kind of a very concrete presentation of the approach. So I'll give you a presentation of an algebraic theory, so a pair sigma E. I'm going to define a particular category. Okay, so this is going to be the Lovier theory of this presentation. And this category as objects has the natural numbers. And then the arrows are going to be, so if you look at the arrows from M to N, this is going to be an N-tuple of terms that may or may not use variables from this particular restricted set of variables. So you can only use variables from X1 to XM. Okay, and you quotient these terms modulo the equations, modulo the relations. Okay, so I'll give you a little example of how this works. Oh yeah, and what is composition then, of course? Composition is substitution. And I'll give you a little example, right? So let's say we're in a theory of monoids. Then a particular arrow from 2 to 1 would be a 1-tuple, so just a single term. And this term is allowed to use two variables. Okay, so this is a particular term in the theory of monoids, x1 times x2. This is another term, x2, x1, x2 times x1. And if we're in commutative monoids, then these two arrows would be equated, right? Because this is an instance of applying an equation of the system. So we generate the congruence induced by the equations. And here's how substitution works. So here I have an arrow from 1 to 2. So it's a 2-tuple, it's a pair. The first term is E, so I don't have to use the variable x1, right? I'm allowed to because my domain is 1, so I can use x1, but I don't have to. So E is a particularly good choice. Here I have x1. Here I have an arrow from 2 to 1, which is just a single term x2 times x1. And then when I substitute, when I compose, what that means is I make this simultaneous substitution. I substitute E for x1 and x1 for x2. Okay, and this is, you can see how this generalizes, right? So basically this gives us the valuations for all the variables that can possibly be used in this term. Okay, so this is, as I said, this is a very, very concrete presentation. And there's a much more beautiful way of saying this. And it's to say that this is the free category of products on the sort of underlying data given by the algebraic theory. But I'm not really going to explain it because it's not an enormous part of the story. What is very interesting then is to give a classical model, is to give a Cartesian functor, so just a functor that preserves products, from this category to the category of sets. So why is that? Well, if you think about it, a Cartesian functor has to preserve products. So in fact, on objects, the functor is totally defined by where you set 1, right? Because then you have to set 2. Oh, I haven't yet told you what the products in this are. So the products are really weird. The products are actually sum. You know, so the product of m times n in this category is m plus n. But essentially, what this means is that to define a functor, it's enough just to, on objects, it's enough just to say where 1 goes. And then the functoriality, the fact that functors preserve composition, means that all these terms are just defined by where you send the generators and of course, the equations are guaranteed to be preserved because of, again, functoriality. I actually have a slide about products. So this is a category of products, but confusingly, as I said, m times n is m plus n. But it's super simple to see why this is the product, right? Why it satisfies the universal property. So first of all, what are the projections? So to give a projection to give an arrow from m plus n to m, I have to give you an m-tuple that uses possibly the variables from x1 to xm plus n. And these are just the projections, right? So I just use the variables x1 up to xm, and here xm plus 1 up to xm plus n. And it's really simple, well, it's really obvious to see why the universal property holds. Well, because if I give you a term here, so if I give you an arrow from k to m, so an m-tuple, and here an n-tuple, then there's a unique thing that you could put here, and it's just a concatenation of these tuples. So this is a category of products. And there's this correspondence between classical models and Cartesian functors. But of course, this kind of solves some of these problems that Lovere would have had with the classical approach to universal algebra, because there's no reason why you have to have set here, right? If you put top, you know, top has products, and then if I let's say take the Lovere theory of groups, then to give a functor is just to give a topological group, right? So this generalizes nicely, and it gets rid of these, the way I presented it, the variables kind of still appear, but you know, if you take the point of view that this is a free object, a free thing, then all this extraneous machinery doesn't play any role anymore. And this slide, so Ross was saying at the start of his talk that, of course, there are some fundamental theorems in quantum mechanics that disallow you from essentially copying and discarding arbitrarily. Right, but copying and discarding arbitrarily is precisely what Cartesian structure allows you to do. Okay, so in any Lovere theory, we always have the arrow, for example, that here forgets the second variable. So this is implicitly throwing away something, right? But this might not, you might not have the ability to throw something away. And you also, of course, have the diagonal, which essentially says copy something, and you might not necessarily be able to copy things, right? In quantum or various applications of computer science. Also, another kind of a slightly maybe not at first obvious consequence is that there are no operations with coarities other than one. And in fact, if you look at the classical definition of algebraic theory, we only had arities. We didn't have coarities. Right? And the reason for this is, of course, you can just project. So any arrow of this type is just a pair. And that's why, you know, in classical universal algebra, we only talk about arities, we don't talk about coarities. And again, I'm going over things that Ross talked about, but let me just very quickly recall the definition of props. So a prop is a strict symmetric monoidal category, where strict simply means that the tensor product is associative on a nose. The objects are natural numbers, and the tensor product of m times n is m plus n on objects. In fact, I normally just write the plus, the tensor as a plus because of this. And some examples that Ross mentioned were permutations of finite sets. So that's a prop. Okay, so the arrows from m, so the only arrows are from m to m, where because and then the arrows are permutations of the m element sets. You also have functions between finite sets. But actually, an interesting example is any Lovere theory gives you one of these guys. Okay, so any Lovere theory is a prop. It so happens that then the tensor product is the Cartesian product. A prop homomorphism is an identity in object symmetric monoidal functor. Okay, so this gives us this new universe to think about algebraic theories and the semantics of algebraic theories. And Ross also mentioned this. So what's a natural, sort of the obvious way one would generalize the notion of algebraic theory to the symmetric monoidal setting? Well, we still give a signature, except now there's no reason to just have coarities of one. Okay, so we give an arity function and a coarity function. And then our equations are again pairs, but now they're no longer ordinary syntactic terms. They're going to be pairs of string diagrams. And you can actually think of them in a fairly syntactic way as things that you construct from sigma identities and symmetries. But you've seen many examples of these things already, so let me just start with what already Ross also gave you an example of, which is the symmetric monoidal theory of commutative monoids. So here we have two generators. We have a generator which is the monoidal action. So the RRT is 2, co-RRT is 1. And we have the unit with RRT 0, co-RRT 1. So here, we're kind of sticking with the sort of classical, you know, the classical world, because all the co-RRTs are 1. And then the equations are simply associativity, commutativity, and unitality, but drawn as string diagrams. So far, the data looks the same. And there's an interesting fact, which I think Ross mentioned, or at least he used this when he was talking about composing props, is that we have an isomorphism of props between this prop of commutative monoids and prop of functions between finite sets, which is kind of interesting, right? It's another way of thinking of finite sets. You think of finite sets as being sort of the theory, the symmetric monoidal theory of commutative monoids. But of course, this is not at all isomorphic to the Loewy theory of commutative monoids, right? Because the Loewy theory of commutative monoids has Cartesian products. And here, we just have a tensor product. So this is where I really want to focus on for the next few minutes and explain. I think I'm going super slow. Okay, maybe I should speed up a little bit. So this is not isomorphic to Loewy theory, but let me just focus on this because I think this is a really interesting, gives an interesting perspective on bialgebras and Hopf algebras. So there's this kind of a folk theorem which I don't really know where to trace it back to. Maybe someone knows and could tell me. So a symmetric monoidal category C is Cartesian. So the tensor product is a Cartesian product, if and only if every object has a commutative co-monoid structure. So we have a co-multiplication in the co-unit, satisfying the usual equations. So co-associativity, co-unitality, and the co-commutativity. And this is compatible with the tensor product in the obvious way. So if you to get the co-monoid structure of the of something tensor something else, you can construct it with the co-monoid structures of the constituents in the obvious way, using the twist. And moreover, every arrow in this category is a co-monoid homomorphism. So what does that mean? It means that everything commutes with the co-monoid structure. So I have an arrow F, then I can take it over the co-multiplication, and I can take it over the co-units. So this kind of gives us a recipe, right? It gives us a recipe of how to think of Loewy theories as symmetric monoidal theories, right? So how does one do this? Well, we'll take all the operations from the Loewy theory. Okay, so they might have a arbitrary RRT, co-RRT of 1. But we need to make the tensor product a Cartesian product. Okay, so we need to give ourselves a co-monoid structure. Okay, this co-monoid structure has to be commutative. And moreover, we have to ensure that all the stuff of the Loewy theory is a co-monoid homomorphism. Okay, so essentially means introducing this equation for every generator and this equation for every generator. So what is the Loewy theory of commutative monoids as a symmetric monoidal theory? Well, we're just following the recipe on the previous slides, and what do we get? We get commutative bialgebra, right? Because we have the monoids, we have the co-monoids, and we have the distributivity. Right? We have the fact that the monoid is homomorphic with respect to the co-monoid structure. So now we have a presentation of the prop. So the Loewy theory considered as a prop, this is the presentation, so we have now these things are isomorphic. And similarly, what's the Loewy theory of a billion groups as an SMT? Well, now we have an additional generator, which is the inverse. Okay, we have all the equations we had previously, except the antipode, or the inverse, is compatible with the co-monoid structure. And we have this additional equation, which of course all of you know. Okay, and this equation is nothing else but just a symmetric monoidal theory version of x times x inverse is equal to e. Right? Because You see that in this equation, x appears twice. So that's why we have to use this, this co-multiplication to copy this variable, so to speak. Right? And here on the right-hand side, we have to forget that variable and output the units. So essentially, summing up those last two slides, as props, the Loewy theory of commutative monoids is isomorphic to the symmetric monoid theory of commutative bialgebra. And for abelian groups, it's the symmetric monoid theory of commutative Hopf algebras. Okay, so the way I think of it as a computer scientist is that bialgebras and Hopf algebras are really exactly monoids and groups, but just in a universe where you can't cheat about copying and discarding. Right? If you want to copy and discard, you have to be explicit about it. That's the way I think of it. Okay, so I want to now move on to the second part of the talk, where we're going to build up this kind of a universe of linear algebra. So let's add some more facts to the biAlgebra fact sheet. Right, so we've just seen that the prop of co-commutative biAlgebras is isomorphic to the prop, which is just the Loewy theory of commutative monoids considered as a prop. But there's two more things, okay? So it's also the prop of spans of finite sets and spans of functions between finite sets, which was mentioned by Ross and relates to the work of Steve Lack and composing props. But another way you can think of it is as the prop of matrices of natural numbers. Okay, so what is this prop? So arrows from M to N are n times m matrices with natural number entries. And composition is matrix multiplication. So this is kind of bizarre. It's one of these first situations, at least when you sort of look at this the first time, you go, where did the natural numbers come from, right? So we're just drawing string diagrams. So this is a useful thing to think about for a few moments if you haven't seen it before. So we can actually define a syntactic sugar. So this is a computer science programming languages term. So it just means we can sort of define these macros, and they're going to tell us what the natural numbers are. Okay, so zero, so all the natural numbers will have arity one and co-arity one. Zero is just sort of the disconnected diagram. And then k plus one is just going to be sort of adding an extra path from left to right. Okay, so one is just the identity. Two will be, maybe I should just, so yeah, so taking this recursive definition, you see that. And so forth. Okay, so this is a really simple recursive definition, and this thing is syntax. So we can use induction to prove a whole bunch of lemmas. And in fact, you sort of recover all of the usual algebra of the natural numbers, right? So addition is written like this. You can add natural numbers with string diagrams like this. And multiplication is just putting them in series. And you've got all these other facts that, for example, allow you to prove things like, you know, multiplication distributes over addition. So all the things that you learn in primary school, you can kind of rediscover from these string diagrams. And this is really where the source of this correspondence with matrices is, right? Because I told you that the prop of biAlgebras is isomorphic to the prop of matrices. So how does this work? Well, a matrix, you can read off, to see the correspondence, to know the, let's say, the ijth entry of the matrix, you start from the jth inputs and go to the ith output and count the paths, okay, in this diagram. So you see that this is kind of how this correspondence works. And yes, Ross mentioned this really nice paper of Steve Lack. And he did mention also that the prop of biAlgebra is really the same thing as span of finite sets. And what does this really mean? Well, and you know that in the category of spans, you compose by taking pullbacks. So it turns out that you can read off all of the equations of bialgebra as certain very simple pullbacks of functions between finite sets. Okay, so here's just a very simple example of reading of how one reads off the well-known bialgebra law. Well, if you have the function, the unique function from 2 to 1, and you take a pullback of it with itself, as a string diagram, you see this is a span, and the string diagram that corresponds to it in the theory of bialgebra is simply the multiplication followed by the co-multiplication. And you can kind of see that, you know, these are pictures that you draw for students of functions, right? They don't look very far away from that. When you take the pullback of these two things in the category of finite sets, of course, you just get the product and the two projections. And when you sort of interpret them in string diagrams, this is what the projection looked like. And so the fact that this is a pullback, and pullbacks is how composition is defined in the category of spans, means that essentially you impose this equation on your algebraic theory. Okay, and this is really nicely explained in Steve's paper, so I encourage you to take a closer look at this. So that was bialgebra. What about Hopf algebra? So we've seen that Hopf algebras are the same thing as the Loewy theory of abelian groups, but they're also the same as they're also isomorphic to the proper integer matrices. Okay, so now we have an arrow is a matrix of integer entries, and composition is matrix multiplication. So this is where the stuff that you probably haven't seen before, unless you've seen me talk before at some other location. So you can kind of keep applying this methodology of composing props to build up more interesting theories. So one question one could ask is, can we get a presentation for the prop of spans of integer matrices? And the answer is yes, actually, because you can prove that this prop of integer matrices has pullbacks. Okay, and you compute these pullbacks. it's really quite easy, but I mean, maybe I don't have time to explain, but if you'd like me to explain, I can do it offline. But essentially, what happens is, for example, if you take the pullback of these two matrices, this is one possible result, and then you sort of follow the methodology that I described in the last slide, and you start reading off equations. Okay. And This equation that you read off here, for example, for this white structure, right? So this is a kind of a matrix going from left to right. This is a matrix going from right to left. It's one of the Frobenius equations. So this is another origin story for Frobenius, which is different from the usual origin story of Frobenius, which is this cospans, which is arising from pushouts. So you also get Frobenius from pulling back matrices or integer matrices. And in fact, in this paper, what we did was we kind of kept thinking about this. Okay, so we start off, this is just the algebraic theory of Hopf algebras together with its opposite. And this is a co-product in the category of props, and Ross already explained how to calculate the co-product. But in particular, in the symmetric monomial theory, this is super simple, because what you do here is you just take the signature of this, the signature of this, the equations of this, and the equations of this, right? So you have kind of Hopf algebras and Hopf algebra is going in the opposite direction, but with no additional equations. Now, I just told you that you can consider, okay, and these things are, of course, going to be isomorphic to matrices. So here, R stands for a principal ideal domain. We've been talking about the integers. This actually turns out to work for any principal ideal domain. And because the prop of matrices is pullbacks, we can use this Steve Lack machinery of composing props to get a presentation in terms of an algebraic theory. And one of the equations that you've already seen is, for example, the Frobenius equation. So the interesting thing, of course, is that if a category of matrices has some limit, then it's also going to have that co-limit. right? Because in matrices, we have the transpose duality. So you can always turn all the arrows around. So if you're satisfying the universal property for a limit, you're also going to satisfy the universal property for a colimit, just by transposing everything. All right, so to calculate the colimit, take the transpose, calculate the limit, and transpose back. So in particular, we get a presentation for cospans with a slightly different equation set. So we're thinking, actually, what happens when you put these two equational theories together, which sort of means taking the push out here, we get this algebraic theory, which I'll describe on the next slide. And we also get that it's going to be isomorphic to whatever happens when you somehow glue together spans of matrices and cospans of matrices. So you take the push out of spans and cospans of matrices. And the very nice thing is that when you calculate this push out, what happens is you get the category of additive relations over the rationals. Okay, if we started with R being the integers. So other people call these linear relations. And I'll explain, of course, all these bits, but I just wanted to give you an outline of how this whole construction works. But let's just concentrate on what this equational theory now looks like. Well, we now have the white monoid, but also the white comonoid, the black comonoid, but also the black monoid, because this is the sort of the Hopf structure turned around. Actually, if I wasn't cheating, I'd have to have two different antipodes, but it's very easy to prove equation that they're the same. So I've made a little efficiency saving here. And now, how do these structures interact? Well, you've already seen something very similar in the previous talk, because in the ZX calculus, you have a very similar interaction. So first of all, the white structure interacts with the other white structure as a special Frobenius algebra. Similarly, the back structure. And vertically, these interact as Hopf algebras. So that gives you most of the structure. And now I just need to tell you a few more things. The first thing, and this is a difference from the ZX calculus, because Ross was telling you that the green cups are equal to the red cups. So here, the cups and caps are not equal. They're related by an antipode. And the final equation that comes out of this recipe that I told you in the previous slide is that whenever p is a natural number not equal to 0, and I take this natural number sugar, syntactic sugar that I defined previously, then they cancel each other out when they point into each other, and they cancel each other out when they point out of each other. Okay, so that's the entire equational theory. So let's just focus on this algebraic theory. I mean, I found this very sort of aesthetically pretty when we first discovered this, because there's just so much symmetry around. So first of all, there are sort of two symmetries one can immediately see. It's that every equation, if you mirror it, is an equation. And this leads to this mirror image dagger, right? The mirror image dagger that just reflects everything. But also, every equation, if you just swap the colors, if you swap black and white, it's still an equation of the system. Okay, then this leads to what I've called the bizarro dagger. So the idea is that you both invert and you swap the colors. So you know already the bizarro dagger in many sort of several concrete settings. So for example, the bizarro of a matrix is the transpose of the matrix. But I should really tell you now what this, I mean, concentrate on the semantics. So the interesting from that slide with the cube, the interesting fact from the cube slide that I showed you is that we have this isomorphism of props between the symmetric monodal theory of interacting Hopf algebras and this prop of linear relations over the rationals. So what is this prop? Okay. So the arrows from M to N are linear subspaces of Q to the M times Q to the N, considered as a Q vector space. Composition is relational composition, right? So you think of these things as relations, and you compose them as relations. And the interesting thing is, maybe somewhat unexpected, is mono product is direct sum. It's direct sum of subspaces. And I actually wanted to make a slide, but I forgot of how this isomorphism actually looks like. So maybe I can just very, very quickly give you an idea of how this works on the board. So for example, let's just do a couple of cases, and then I think it will become clear. So where is this, what linear relation that this guy does the black co-multiplication correspond to? Well, this should be something inside Q times Q squared. And we've been thinking about this black structure as doing copying before, right? So it's still doing the copying. It's the obvious co-diagonal considered as a linear relation. Okay, the co-units. It's just the discarding, right, which is in Q times Q to the zero. Q to the zero, of course, is the zero dimensional space. So let's just use star as the zero of this. Now this guy corresponds to x, y, x plus y. And finally, this guy is star zero. It's just the one element, it's just a singleton. Okay, and this should give you an idea of how you can sort of concretely think about this isomorphism. 10 minutes to go before questions. Okay. That's all right, I'm coming to the end. So we have a presentation, we have this algebraic presentation of the prop of linear relations. And in fact, this has some generalizations, which you already saw on the cube slide. So in particular, this works whenever R is a principal ideal domain. And then what, instead of getting the rational numbers, you get the field of fractions of R as this as your prop of linear relations. And I'm not going to say anything about this, but let me just mention that taking the polynomial ring is particularly interesting, and this has lots of applications in computer science and systems and control theory, and this is very closely related to the work of John Byers and Jason Abeley on categories and control, which is really beautifully summarized in Jason's PhD thesis. Okay, so I'm just going to spend the last few minutes telling you about how now we rediscover linear algebra and fields in this totally algebraic setting, right? So, you know, we're used to thinking of linear relations of linear subspaces as a collection of points, but now we can really just think of them as diagrams. This is an isomorphism, so we can forget about points. So first of all, I explained how the natural numbers work, right? So let's have a think about how rational numbers work. And now let's sort of move up a few classes in primary school and rediscover rational arithmetic from string diagrams. Okay, so a rational number, P over Q, is simply the string diagram that looks like this. Okay, so when you unpack this in tactic sugar, you know, 2/3 is this very concrete string diagram that looks like this. And then you can start proving little lemmas. So for example, what happens when I put two of them in series? Well, there's some lemmas here involved, but essentially you would discover the usual product formula for multiplying fractions, but also the usual sum formula for adding up fractions. Okay, and all of this you just rediscover from the string diagrams. So there's no rational numbers encoded here. And you know, I'm not taking pairs of natural numbers modulo an equivalence relation with the proviso that the determinant is non-zero. Because when you think about it, like the way we normally define things is not that beautiful. But yes, nobody told string diagrams that you can't divide by zero. And I think that this is actually, if you look at sort of the rational numbers as living inside these string diagrams, that this in a way fixes some deficiencies of this usual syntax that we learn in primary school. Right, so what's, so this is the diagram for zero, which we already saw before when we were talking about natural numbers. And now, as you saw from the definition, the reciprocal of a number is just a number going the other direction. So we have something which looks like 1 divided by 0, which is this string diagram. But of course, when you start doing this, people get very nervous because then you have these bizarre things like 0 divided by 0, which don't really have any good interpretation. The reason why they don't is because the syntax is just terrible. Right? So in fact, this doesn't really make sense because the zero sugar doesn't commute with other sugars, or doesn't commute with the zero sugar in particular. So looking at this is a different string diagram to this. So there's two different interpretations for what sort of zero divided by zero should mean. And I know this, if you haven't seen this before, then it must sound very mysterious and maybe somewhat crazy. But actually, there's a very simple way to make sense of this if you've seen projective arithmetic. Okay, so you know in projective arithmetic, the usual thing is just to identify a rational, or let's say a real number, with the line for the origin in the two-dimensional space with the slope that number. Okay, then zero is the x-axis, infinity is the y-axis. Now, if I think of these lines as relations, okay, this is how this will work. Now, if I compose these relations, this is just the same as multiplication. And if I do the thing that the string diagrams suggest, I get addition. But of course, my diagrams from with one y on the left and one y on the right, they correspond precisely to all of the additive relations of the two-dimensional plane. Okay, so there are two more things that are not lines, that are subspaces. So there's the zero-dimensional subspace, which is just the point at zero. There's the two-dimensional subspace, which is everything. Okay, and these are this is the zero point, and this is the whole two-dimensional plane. And then you can sort of start, you know, having fun with this and reading off the addition and the multiplication table, and it all makes sense. And so I'll tell you the cutest equation, right? Because most of it is sort of what you expect, like these guys kill everything, but not always. So for example, when you add this to this, you get infinity. You get this, which is cute. And actually, you can, I mean, this, it's not just completely esoteric. I've made this, you know, actually compute things. So I have some examples if you're interested. Right, so that's us discovering the rational numbers as certain string diagrams and the algebra of rational numbers. So I'm running over time, so I just want to give you now a little flavor of how you can do linear algebra, right? Because so far we've only really looked at diagrams with one y on the left, one y on the right. So one sort of nice property, one consequence of this cube construction that I showed you is that every diagram can be seen as a span or a cospan of matrices. So every linear relation, every linear subspace can be put in these kinds of syntactic forms. And it turns out that these things give you a meaningful interpretations. Okay, so here I've just got some examples of linear subspaces. And what's a linear subspace, right? So you can define a linear subspace as the solution set of a list of homogeneous equations. Okay, so that's a linear subspace. And that turns out to correspond precisely to putting these string diagrams in cospan form. And you can almost read, right? It's kind of, this is why I really like the syntax, because you can really read the, you know, so this is, we're looking at the, so this diagram here, minus all of the extra details that I've got here. What it means is we're interested in the subspace of Q to the power 3, where x plus y is equal to 0 and z can be anything, right? So z can be anything. We don't have an equation that limits it, okay? And this is precisely the string diagram for that, and you can almost sort of read off the specification, right? So you add x plus y, and this should equal to 0, and z can be anything. And this sort of looks similar. And all of these things are in cospan form, and you kind of, to make sense of these diagrams, you read them from left to right. Now, in span form, you read things from right to left, and then you're going to think of a linear space as a linear combination of basis vectors. So let's just go for one example, for example, over here. Let's say we want to consider the space generated by these two vectors. So a linear combination, we kind of need some scalar A and some scalar B, but these guys can be arbitrary. So let's generate, now we're going to read these diagrams from right to left. Let's generate an A, copy it. Here, let's generate a B, copy it. And now you see that here, I need things of the form A minus A. So here I have an A and a minus A. Here I have, here I'm going to need 1 and 2. So here I have the B, I multiply by 2. And then I just need to add them up here in the middle. And right, so these are, these string diagrams, they give us a different syntax, a different way of talking about linear algebra. Yes. Stop. Okay, this is my second last slide. Yes. Okay, so let me just give you a flavor. Of course, I can't give you the details because there's no time. But, let's say the kernel of A is this particular string diagram. The image of A is this particular string diagram. And you can start sort of proving, first-year linear algebra theorems. Like A is injective if and only if char of A is zero. And so I've kind of been doing this. So I've been running this blog in which I sort of slowly, it's been very slowly recently, describe how one does linear algebra with string diagrams. And there's a whole bunch of papers where sort of different parts of this are worked out and the examples and the applications are figured out. And in particular, the applications to control theory and systems theory. So thank you very much for your attention. Sorry, say that again. I couldn't.
The prop of commutative covariance seems to play a distinct
yes,
role.
Yes, sure. It's the initial Lovier theory. Yes.
Okay. Does it arise from a function within props of Lovier theories as a covariance props?
That's a good question. I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, and it also seems like every prop canonically distributes over that one. Is this not true?
Every prop?
Canonically distributes over the prop of commutative covariance.
No, that's only, so there you really need the fact that in Lovier theory, all the operations have chirality one. So if you have chirialities other than one, then this distribution is not obvious, right? So that's, you can see that when you start drawing the diagrams. Yes?
So if you take this free category to interacting with these algebras, a form Hopf algebra and so on, and basically with the rational numbers that we can say, does that mean that the endomorphism monoid on one wire is basically Q together with
these
two additional elements.
Yes.
All right, interesting. Oh, sorry. You were using natural number matrices, that category I think is also equivalent to the spans and finite sets.
Yes.
So secretly you were using spans of spans and cospans of spans.
Yes. But okay, though. But you see, because the matrices of natural numbers don't have pullbacks.
Uh-huh.
Don't have pullbacks. So you need integers. That's why there was this step. And in fact, that's kind of a slightly shady point in the story where maybe I don't yet understand all the details. Kind of. But by the way, this trying to figure out what it should mean for the case of natural numbers is super interesting, and has all kinds of computer science applications. But it doesn't work in the same way, because the matrices of natural numbers don't have pullbacks. And so to make this work, you really need the integers. And that's why the Hopf algebras came into the story.
Okay.